Harry Salgado and Jerry Morales, Jerry Powell. I'm going to let them introduce themselves, please. Just a very brief introduction. I'd like to remind our panelists that we'll keep the conversation going, but we'll kind of get to the point. Let's be kind of, you know, want to keep this to about, you know, good 45 minutes. And so we're going to touch on, I have a good 10 different subject matters.
My name is William Reyes from City of El Cerrito. Started teaching in 1981, where you can find over here in these flyers here. And I haven't stopped, so any questions I can ask, there you go.
And I'm Karen Salgado. I grew up in Highland Park, California. Spent most of my scholastic years there and developed, I kind of got roped in because my sister and her friend Marcia Hernandez, Judy Salgado and Marcia Hernandez, started the Divine Dolls. And I think I'm an honorary member because I was her sister. And here I am. Now I'm currently working in the entertainment industry, working for a music company, and music has left me, so here I am.
Gerard Bass, I started DJing in 1983. Out of Lincoln High School, did parties Lincoln Heights, El Cerrito, and beyond since then.
One of the first questions I had was about like how did you come about the place, the location of this party? Did you have the system down? Did, you know, who were usually the first scouts out there?
What I remember first about house parties in the old days is we had to figure out who had a sound system. Because no matter what, we can have any location, and locations are easy to find because we all lived at home. You know, back in the days, there wasn't too many over 21 and over people that were donating their house. A lot of the times we were borrowing relatives and parents' houses and stuff. So getting houses was a problem. The problem was pulling the sound system together. And because we were all like 15, 16, none of us could drive, so it's about getting the sound system from one location to another. So, you know, basically the ones who had the sound system and can organize it and get it from one location to the other were the ones doing the scouting, finding a location, someplace that had, you know, a house that would have something like a parking lot or something where you would have to, you wouldn't have to put a gas for it. Even though, like, it didn't matter, they'd still have parties in the dirt and in the mud and stuff like that. They would always try to look for something that had, you know, a parking lot, something that had some kind of, you know, a gate to keep people in the back and stuff like that. I mean, from what I remember, it was basically about who had the sound system, how it's going to get there, and who's going to do it. Then after that, I mean, with a few phone calls and a few flyers, everybody was there. So what I can remember was basically just pulling the sound together first.
We used to, for a brief moment, for like two summers or a summer and a fall, we would make flyers with an address and it would just say something something Marengo Avenue. And then we'd pile up into a car that had the sound system and then we'd drive up and down Marengo Avenue between Soto and Eastern and peek in the backyard and see who had a nice backyard, and then we just ask them and offer them $50, sometimes up to $75 depending on what time was the sun disappearing on us or not. We had to get a system going, and we'd get a house, and that was pretty much it. You know, $50, $75, let us in your backyard, and, you know, keep it cool, and it was good. We were very fortunate to have that luck. Also, just a lot of people wanted to have parties, so they say, hey, I want to have a party, I have a big backyard, can you do it? Can we keep the door? Yeah, sure, okay. And that was it.
How would you work out, like, security? I mean, you know, the amazing thing I remember about before these house parties is walking into these people's homes, and, you know, to use a restroom, or, you know, maybe you know you're on the kitchen or something. Like, did you provide like a sense of someone with security or with trust?
I don't remember us asking people to use their bathroom. I think most of the people just, you know, a la natural. But security-wise, I know my father worked the door a couple of my parties. I would work the door with, I'd have a friend. I always made sure I had a friend that stood here to help me with anything. And, you know, later on when we got a little more organized, we would have like t-shirts made, and I'd make sure that anybody who I had given a t-shirt to wore the t-shirt to the party to at least make it seem like there was a lot of workers. Not necessarily that they were working, but just the visual that, oh wow, these guys are all kind of dressed the same, anything goes down.
What did they say?
Oh, we had Rat Pack t-shirts or, you know, something, you know, that we don't have.
Well, in my case, being a girl promoter, we didn't actually put the parties together or put on flyers to promote the party. Now, there were some other girl promoters that would throw parties along with the boy promoters and the DJs, but in my case, we would just be there to promote.
And would you get cut?
Well, like actually, some I'm sure did, but with us, it was more of a camaraderie kind of thing. It's our friends, we're there to help them promote their parties, you put us in a flyer, can you get 10 girls in for free? Because, you know, when you're young and you're 14, 15, you don't have that kind of money to throw around, even though it's like $2, $3 at the time. But you were part of that community, you were part of the scene, and of course, you know, being part of the scene was very important when you're young.
What was their tactics that you used to differentiate yourself from other promoted groups?
You know what's interesting about that, that you would touch on that? Fashion came into play a lot. So, you know, the coined term of dress to impress was used heavily when you're going to a club or when you're going to a backyard party, but that's what you would set yourself different from the rest of that you were dressed to impress.
How would you dress?
Oh, ridiculously in mini skirts and pumps and a lot of shoulder pads. I mean, it was the 80s, so. Big on Aquaman, the white can. We all love the white can and the pink can. And we had hair that probably caused global warming.
Okay. With organizing these parties, I know that there were also became somewhat of an underground economy that started happening, or something that you might have even depended on, or was it like a part-time gig? I'm curious also as to the more and more money that started coming in for the bigger the parties, how it was that you guys organized yourselves like, to deal with this, and if it had created any problems.
There was no organization. It was all out of control. There was so much money coming in. Like, the people who were throwing the parties basically didn't know what to do with it, in a sense, because they surely didn't invest it in the next party. You know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of times, whatever money was made that night was spent that night, you know?
What would you say an average, maybe a good night for a party would be?
For a backyard party, $2 a person, and then some beers and stuff like that, and sodas and waters.
People can make a specific price of beer, soda, and water.
Yeah, you get like a cup, and then you buy a cup for like $5, and then you go into a cake, and you're pouring beer out there, you know? So
yeah.
It depends, because sometimes there would be people there. A lot of the time, people just took their own beer. You know, it was one of the backyard parties are about bring your BYOB. Dress to impress, BYOB. There's a couple of things that were coined in those days. They didn't have like full bars, they didn't have like a lot of things that are accessible in nightclubs, you know? So, but the money that was made, I mean, an average night of a backyard party running from like, you figure 9 o'clock at night till about midnight, because they didn't really go that long, you know, they can make anywhere from $500 to $1,000. And that was a long time ago. And that's from what I remember, people just counting, ones, tens, fives, just nonstop. And it was kind of weird, because I mean they were paying for security, there was a lot of organization, but in a sense when it comes to the promoters that were doing it, like I didn't see too much organization, because there was always those people trying to figure out how we have the next party, trying to group up other organizations so we can all pitch in to have the next party. So, and I personally remember a lot of that time was the money that was made being spent like right after, you figure the party's over at midnight. They take all the money, they go to the store, buy all the alcohol, and then they end up like at the next cruising spot where they drink all the alcohol and everyone's passing out flyers and the party continues.
Yeah.
And it's over, there was a lot of money coming in. From what I remember, like in the early 80s, 82, 83. And then the following years, like in 83, 84, all of a sudden, when there would be backyard parties or house parties or barbecues, like the police would come over and start taking the money. Because at first they wouldn't take the money. They'd come over and say, turn the music down, you know, keep everything cool, your neighbors are complaining, we're giving you a warning, you know? But then once they started getting, because that whole scene was a phenomenon in itself. It wasn't something that had been going on for a long time and people were doing that a lot. It was like, wow, this is what's going on. You know, this is how much they made, and little by little, more, all these promoters that were on the fire, the following months started having all their own parties. So you just had like a big explosion of promoters having parties everywhere, right? So now we have promoters having parties against promoters, and we have people that are just all trying to, in a sense, compete against each other because they realize the financial gain, you know? But at the same time, the police realized the financial gain too, so they started coming over, and instead of warning people, instead of stopping people on the half, they started fining people, getting tickets, fining the houses that were being rented out, taking the sound systems, straight out taking the money from the cash register, saying they're using it as evidence. Like a lot of things, like police brutality then, you know, and gangster taking the money like that, it was no different then than it is now, in a sense, you know? Except I think us, as the ones who did the backyard parties, we were the ones who invented like certain city ordinances, because before we had backyard parties, I don't think they had a problem with loud music, you know what I'm saying? Where like you have to have permits and you have to, you know, pay certain fees and all stuff like that. Before they realized that we were making money, those things didn't exist. Once they realized that we were making money, then all those things started falling into place, just like anything else. So there was a lot of money coming in.
There was a big economy that sprang up from backyards only. I mean, as we know, we have Ultimate Crave in the house, and one of the biggest sound systems, you know, in the city. DJ supply stores still dot the downtown area, and there was even more before in the east side. Exodus being one of my favorites. Audio Climax, family thing for Willie. So there was a big economy in terms of sales of equipment. Also, flyers was a big industry that happened. And I'm sure, you know, the sales of cakes rose during the 80s. But I'm a little later generation than Willie, and we kind of had a little more organization that we saw that, you know, we, like I mentioned, we would provide t-shirts to our friends to make it look like there was more people working. We would, we had a sound guy that we always took care of. You know, we made sure that we were going to pay him X amount of dollars, and he was going to load in, and he was going to load out, and we didn't have to worry about a thing. We had to worry about, yeah, the cops or whatever. And if the cops did show up, our sound guy was an older guy who we would put up there and say, oh, I'm the owner of the house, and la, 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 la. And it was like a routine. Like, we kind of, like, made contingency plans. Like, what if this happens? What if this happens? And yeah, sometimes the cops would try to come and pull some quick ones like that, like evidence and blah, blah, blah. And we'd go, well, you know what? We're just going to shut down. Do you want these 500 people out on the street? Or do you want them in here, you know, and we'll slowly just kill it off? You know, we'll start playing messed up music. And they'd be like, well, yeah, we're going to have to call 5 cars more to take care of 500 people in the street, or just let you guys handle it, you know. And then by that time, we had all our people out front with the shirts, just going, hey, and walk back in to show that we had a presence. It was, we had a little organization within ourselves. When we began to reach out of the Lincoln Heights, Sereno area, into Sereno, there was more cop involvement there. I don't know, because there was more homeowners. But where there was renters, it was definitely a lot easier to throw parties. Highland Park was very hard to throw parties in there. Every party in Highland Park was busting. Yeah, Caesar from the Twins, you could attest to that. You know? And so a lot of times we'd bring homies over from Highland Park to play with us in Lincoln Heights and moving into City Terrace and like the outskirts of Sereno. If you went into the middle of Sereno, like Poplar and all that, you were done. The closer you got to Alhambra, the hotter the cops were. The closer you got into Highland Park and Eagle Rock, the closer the cops were. So you can see how property value, homeownership had a role in law enforcement cracking down in this, you know, youth subculture, particularly led by Latinos.
I just have to say, El Cerrito had one of the greatest house parties that I've been to.
Maybe you could expand on that. question with that. And so, I always love hearing, you know, and of course there's always stories, you know, too. Party that happened.
I mean,
you
I
can tell us a little bit about.
I can't tell you.
What was the best? Why was it the best?
Well, I guess it was the best because I had the greatest time. It was memorable. I met a lot of new friends. There's not one particular instance. They were just all good. And it just seemed like in certain particular demographic areas, like Highland Park, because I grew up there, I attended to a lot of those house parties. And then when the whole entire crowd and the whole scene was more the popular known DJs and crews that were throwing parties, and it was the Lincoln Heights area and El Sereno. And El Sereno is really, really popular because when you're young, you don't know anything. You're like, why is that popular? You know, let's go check it out. So you cruise. Sometimes there's like two parties, three parties, five parties in like different blocks, but in that same general area. Why is that? You know, who's pulling in all these people? So we'd all check them out and everything.
Well, one thing I remember also was like just the act of cruising, like, you know, was it the party in itself or what other kind of like,
well,
you know, thing?
It's,
like,
it's different because when you're young, you don't have a club to go to, you know, unless you're a gangster or part of a gang that just harassed people. But this, everybody knew it was like a good thing, dancing, you're supposed to dance, get to meet new people from different schools, and that was a thing, you know, that was like kind of like the community. You want to see who goes to which school, and what places are really hot. And we had house parties, we didn't have clubs back then. And we either did nighttime backyard parties or barbecues. So really, really, Sundays was really big. So.
What about the ditching
parties? Ditching parties are very prominent too. I mean, I went to one ditching party. I was kind of blown away because, you know, you're not supposed to be skipping school, but I skipped school. There was lights and sounds. It's daytime. Who's going to see the lights? But there were. You know, it was like that whole scene, and that's what encompassed. It was a very fun and bizarre, wild time. And it's like you have young kids and you have high schooler kids. I don't know, were there any adults? Really? I think I probably had an adult. Oh, Steve, the photographer.
And, you know, maybe you can kind of elaborate on this. Like, I mean, one thing I wonder about is, like, what was it that these parties were providing? Like, why was the audience so big? Like, what did you notice, just kind of, maybe were there peaks, you know, like during the year?
The music brought everything. Like, it wasn't anything else. It was the promoters who knew people and they were all friends. It wasn't just friends supporting each other. It was a little bit more because you had different parties that you could choose from. You can choose to go to a party where you're not going to enjoy the music, or you can choose to go to a party where you know for sure the music is going to be the best. And a lot of the times, because the whole dance phenomenon, the whole DJ phenomenon was just barely happening in those early 80s, everything was new. Everything was new. So it was about getting to the place, like she said, where you heard of the more popular DJs who were playing not just in the backyards, but were also playing in the clubs. You want to see those DJs because you can't get into the clubs, so you want to see them at the backyards. You understand? So if you have five parties to choose from, and you have all these DJs, but these DJs are at the clubs, you want to go to the backyard party where you have the club DJs because they're going to play all the newest, latest, hottest, coolest music. Yeah.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the what kind of audience you started forming?
Me, it was a little bit different because unlike other DJs, I didn't perform for just one promotion group. Like, I performed for many different promotion groups. So as to where one DJ was playing one style of music for one crowd of people,
but
for
what
one promotion
kind of
group.
What
for instance, it wasn't hip hop, it was like funk in a sense. You can have like a funk DJ with a funk promoter at a funk crowd. And then you can have a new wave DJ with a new wave promoter with a new wave crowd. You would hardly ever see the two mix. They would just be, you know, consistent with their own crowds. But for me, I played at all the different music at all the different crowds with all the different promoters. So it wasn't just one style of music for me. I realized that it was the new music for me of any style that was going to keep me at a certain level. You know? And as a musician, because I'm like not just a DJ, like I'm a always just about music. Like, it wasn't about anything else, you know, other than providing something that no one's ever heard before, something that they're gonna love, something that's gonna be like the next, you know, expression, you know, is what it was for me.
Do any of you have any number of PC riffs?
That's new in a sense because turntables are new. They're barely inventing certain things that are, you know, they barely started inventing like, you know, programs. Like, it's still a new phenomenon nonetheless. You know, we haven't had DJisms in the 50s and 60s and stuff like that. It was completely different then than it was when you were combining two songs together, you know, to have one sound, you know? So it was kind of weird because you have this whole dance scene that was going on of people that were dancing, but on the underground scene, you have this whole East Coast influence of breakdancers and pop rockers. That was a whole other kind of underground scene. And the funny thing about it is that I remember people coming from all over Baldwin Park, South Bay, Orange County, everywhere to Alsuna. And I was like, well, where are you from? And stuff, you know, like, how, you know, nice to meet you. Stuff like that. Well, we're dancers. We're from over here. We're from over there. I'm like, what the hell are you doing in El Cerrito? How did you hear about El Cerrito? Well, this is where the music's at. Oh, okay. Well, I understand because I'm a DJ from El Cerrito. So, well, so you have a lot of dancers and a lot of, you know, these hip-hop, I mean, early pop rockers and break dancers who were going to the parties and everything, and they were the ones that were in the middle of the crowds, but it was basically the DJs and the promoters that pulled everybody there that kind of, like she said, organized. Like she said, promoted everything, and like we did play it, you know. And like for us, for instance, when we would get together, where like he's a promoter and she's a female promoter, I'm a leader. Like our parties were always at certain levels because you had top end lights, you had top end DJs, you had top end fashion, you had top end promoters, you had security, you had a lot of things that little by little evolved, you know what I'm saying? And that was the cool thing about El Cerrito. It was really kind of like one of those places that set the standards. I don't know, it was kind of weird because I would see things that happened in El Cerrito happen first, and then what happened at the LA Sports Arena, happened at the Convention Center, happened at the Pico River Sports Arena. I'm like, hey, you saw that in El Cerrito, you know what I'm saying? And that would come to, you know, that would be like certain ways they set up the sound system, certain ways the promoters handled the front door, certain ways they had the backstage line, the way they had the sisters set up with like their guest list. I mean, they treated all the promoters. It was different back then. It was like, okay, a part of people were trying to make money and they were trying to understand what was going on, and some of them were just about to have a good time, you know? So you had people that were like, okay, we'll give you some guests, and you know, the DJ can have a couple of people, and then you had other promoters that were just, everybody coming, you know? So it was interesting, the times, how it was a new thing, and people weren't really sure what to do, where it was going to go. They all thought it was temporary, and years later, I mean, if you go through all these binders and take into consideration, like the financial gain, I mean, think about how much money we made off of it, you know what I'm saying? Like, we put off of it at one point, you know, at a level. At that time, how many bottles were in El Cerrito off of it, you know? It wasn't just music. It wasn't just backyard parties that we contributed to. We contributed to the whole phenomenon of the shoes, the clothes, the records, the equipment, like the flyers, the locations, the security, the booze, not even getting into the drugs.
Oh, that's not getting into that. But one of the, like, again, Willie comes from just a couple, we're not that far apart. But Willie, well, yeah, he was a couple of years ahead of me in the game. Not in years, but just in the game. So my experience is a little different, and geographically, you know, we kind of crisscrossed, but we didn't. But our experience was slightly different. And one person who said it best for me one time was Cesar De Niro, the promoter for Teddy Boys. He said, because this was already like late, early 90s, you know, we ran into him, we were hanging out with Cesar, and, you know, he's the veteran, so we give him props and all. And he, you know, we were doing raves and undergrounds by then. He's like, you know what? at the end of the day, it's about boys wanting girls and girls wanting boys. And, you know, the music's just background, you know, to a large degree, you know. Yeah, you know, there was a unique style in the mixing and the music being presented. There wasn't radio stations that played it. By the time we kind of got into it, it was the birth of Power 106, and they were starting to play, like, Mandalay and some stuff that we were playing in the club, in the backyard parties and in the clubs. So now, instead of the DJs like Willie and his generation and earlier would play music that nobody else had, now we, as DJs, were competing against a radio station that was playing stuff that we had been playing and new stuff. So we had to keep up on two fronts. On the music tip, again, my era kind of looked at that mezcla or that mixing. You know, we have the twins here, and they would always handle the hip-hop for us. They were, like, incredible turntablists. And, you know, they'd rock the funk for us. Richard would get on and do, like the freestyle. And I would do, like, what we would call the 21 and over disco, the high-energy stuff. And so we would run the gamut of sounds for 20 minutes each. You know, because by this time, we were talking, like, 30, 40 DJs and a flyer. It was, you know, pretty ridiculous. And we didn't want to have just one sound because, you know, one time you're playing at a party and, you know, there was still homeboys around from the Avenues or Clover or whatever. And if the twins were on, I'd say, hey, man, sorry, but we got to cut you off to get these guys out. And we'd throw on some super fast chipmunk disco and boom, the cholos walk right out the door. And then, okay, Caesar, you can get back on. You know? Because we didn't necessarily want that element in the party because it wasn't just about partying for them. It was other things involved than just having a good time.
You know, on a somewhat of a side note, maybe. What was curious was that you were talking about, let's say, about the sexuality and a guy, you know, he's chasing girls, girls chasing guys, and everything. But also, like, I've known disco to be somewhat of like a political movement in a way for the gay community, and the fact that. Mexican-American community, not limited to, but predominantly, I'd say, how that phenomenon was, how they kind of, co-opt the culture, or kind of, how was it?
Gays, disco, and Latinos, okay. It's in my book. yes, disco went through a very bad rap in the late 70s. Disco Sucks was a t-shirt that people wore. So rock came in and kind of took things over for, you know, 79, 80, you know. It was all about rock. And they had taken out disco, which by this time was gay, you know, the epitome of it being what? The Village People. YMCA in the Navy, blah, blah, blah. It's where chaps. And you had this community, you know, that existed, the gay community. They didn't want to stop dancing. You know, once you've got the disco going and the beats going and the freedom to congregate and have a good time, they just went underground. You know, and so they kept dancing. They kept disco alive in Hollywood, in San Francisco, parts of Chicago, Detroit, New York, you know, and they kept doing their thing. What happened here in relation to what we're talking about is a couple of Latinos, be they gay or straight, would go to Geno's or different gay clubs in Hollywood, but not in East LA, and they'd go and hear this music and see these people. Now, some of these guys, like I said, were gay, and they would bring some girls along, and so then the straight guys would go, oh, that girl's going, I better go to see what's going on. And so you'd have people like Tony Largo, Steve Beltran, and other guys going to Geno's and witnessing Michelangelo DJ. Michelangelo was a DJ at Geno's, and he just, like, was doing all these magical things, it seemed at the time, mixing records. And, you know, Largo, you know, I have him quoted saying, you know, as soon as I heard him do his first mix, I go, that's what I want to do. You know, he always played around with playing DJ, he said, at home since he was a little kid, but once he saw a mix and saw the power that this guy had over a dance floor with, affecting someone's mood, the tempo that they danced, how he kind of moved them to the bar and then moved them right back onto the dance floor, he said, wow, I gotta have that kind of juice and that kind of power. And so they started taking that kind of idea of DJing back to the East Side. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, a lot of people that are from the East Side, we have a hard time crossing that river. We come over to Tommy's and we run right back. Maybe we'll go to the beach twice a year, but we'll go right back. But we, you know, be it because maybe we have an accent, maybe we don't know how to dress like people on this side of the river, or how we think people on this side of the river dress, we segregate ourselves, and also we are segregated. There are straight out racisms and invisible borders that people put up, you know, dress codes and such, and they exclude it. So Latinos, like the gay community, we went and did our own undergrounds. And those were these backyard parties. These were these discos at Club 47 and at Rudy's Pasta House at Kennedy Hall. One night only, but it was an underground. It was a club where we could get together, listen to new music with ourselves, dress how we wanted, feel comfortable, just like gay people had been doing to keep disco alive all those years.
Would you say the house party scene was very hetero, even at that, I mean, you picture a bunch of young kids drinking,
you know,
the whole scamming.
Right. Well, I think in house parties, it wasn't gender specific. You know, we didn't see, you know, straights or gays. We're all there, all mixed in together. And this is early 80s. No one was outed. It was really hard to out someone. I mean, except for those who are very flamboyant, that lets themselves be known that they are gay. Majority of the time, it was very, you know, on the DL. But I don't think it was ever gender-specific when it comes to house parties. I mean, you know if it's you're going to a gay club, because everybody knows it's a gay club. When it comes to house parties, it's open game for everybody. Or, I mean, that's in my view.
And I just kind of remember, like, you pretty much step into a party, and you get the vibe right away. Like if it was more like gangster, more like, you know, specific. I remember myself a lot of, kind of towards the end, it almost got like if you were in a gang or something, there were just certain promoter groups that you could not, you know, you could not go there because they were there. There was usually a big fight that would break out. There was often drive bars, I remember, where everyone hits the ground and then lock later, so they drive off, people would get up.
That's when money started becoming more of an issue. You know, when people started realizing, okay, look, we have the potential as a group or as a promotion group to make money. We don't want anybody else to have a party on the same day, on the same block, in the same city. So that's when people started saying, okay, look, let's get together. Let's go over here and take off their club. Let's drop the dime and call the cops on their party. Let's break up this party. Like, there was a lot of that stuff going on, because what happens is, as soon as one party's over, everyone's going to the other club.
Some of the biggest kind of, groups, maybe promoter groups or DJs that could not really be at the same party, or were there certain camps within the party scene that you remember?
I do remember, well, you know what, I do remember that there was a lot of that madness going on, but at the same time, I always kept distance from it, because as a musician, as a DJ, as a performer, like, it's different. At least for me, because like I said, I've always been raised through my family, my grandfather was a musician, so we've always had this presence of being on stage and backstage. So as a DJ at a backyard party, in the band of our club, I always had that presence of being on stage and being backstage. So although I did realize and witness all kinds of stuff as well, like every little single group that was there, I really had no attention to it, because as soon as one group would leave, one party that they were breaking up, chances are I was going to go DJ at the next group's party as well, because I was getting hit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's how it was to lose, because you have a whole system there, right?
Sometimes when we had systems there, yes, but for the most part, we would just take records, you know? And for me, as a young DJ who didn't even really have a mentality to get caught up in the politics of ego, you know what I'm saying? Like, it made no difference to me. Like, I could... Literally, there was times where I was like DJing for one promotion group who was fighting with someone outside, and then I'd go end up DJing at the other promotion group who they keep fighting with, because I had contract. You know, so it didn't matter to me. I really kind of kept the distance. But there was a lot of like going towards the ending. of backyard parties, a lot of separatism. There was a lot of groups that were turning against other groups. To this day, there's still people that are going around pulling off other people's flyers from freeways and stuff like that. And there's still a lot of that competition going on because people are still trying to make their money now. You know, it's different from backyard parties because they're renting out clubs.
And what's interesting is that when you're a girl promoter, and it's kind of superficial, you want to be on top. Top is the best. So when you start to see your name going down from the line, you're like trying to fight to win your way back to top. So again, you know, you go in with the hottest next girl group or girl crew, and you do a conjunction with. So when you're doing parties, and even like school dances, when there's one that's there, you start to say, well, no, this is our school, this is our turf. So it does become competitive and political in a sense. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, we've been victims of that, and, you know, fight ourselves to the top and try to get ourselves, you know, be known that, you know, this is our turf. Because it is territorial, wouldn't you say? Like, you can tell which DJ or promotional crew is in what cities, because there's the Boyle Heights crew, the El Sereno is very prominent, Heights, Highland Park, I mean, what else? East LA. They're all over the place, so you have to defend your turf in some weird way.
We were lucky in Lincoln Heights to have united, so to say, a lot of the DJs that kind of came up with us, along with some Highland Park DJs and City Terrace and El Sereno DJs. And so when the new guys came in, and they didn't hire any of us, we'd just throw a party against them, and we didn't have to call the cops. People would just come to our parties. But that only lasted, you know, a couple of years. By 88, 89, it did get really ugly. You had people, like Willie was saying, just in it for the money, and sometimes they didn't even have... They said they had a DJ, but that guy just had no clue what a DJ was. They really sucked, and they were returning to gangsterism. Like, you know, in my research, I looked at police records, and gangsterism was very low, you know, almost non-existent from like 82 to 88, you know, because everybody was cha-cha, everybody was dancing, everybody was DJing. But again, by 88, 89, you began to see gangsterism come back in, and in conjunction with the rise of what? Crack cocaine. You know, in Lincoln Heights, there was a DJ crew, I can't remember their name right now, but they turned into the Eastlake Boys, which were a very notorious gang of Eastlake, and they ran the crack cocaine business, you know, in Lincoln Heights for many, many years, you know, after that. But they started off as DJs, you know, coming to different parties, and, you know, they just they were the guys who were always in the fights. And if you had something to lose, like Willie, as a DJ, or as a sound guy, or as a promoter, a reputation, you know, you wanted to rise up there, you wouldn't get into fights, because you wouldn't be invited to the next one. No one would want you at the next one. But some of these guys just, you know, made it that long in the business, and then boom, just went back to selling drugs and, you know, creating all that madness.
And also, I'm sure that when you mix alcohol in with, you know, these young kids, you know, letting testosterone, and then you have, like, you know, you're in someone's neighborhood for a while, and maybe you're in a different gang territory, you know, and they want to come into the party, and why should they pay for, you know, to get into a party like their neighborhood, and you're really the guest throwing the party for that, you know, or you have certain people cruising, you know, that you don't get along with, or homeboy scammed on so-and-so, and that's her boyfriend, and baby's dad, you know, I just remember so much drama within that, you know, it was very, very, to me that was very interesting, just to see all the dynamics with the party coming together, you know, and this huge spectacle that comes about, you know, through the music, through the dancing, and, you know, kids flossing, and, you know, dad's looking to make sure no one steals, you know, something in the house, and, you know, you have kids peeing on the side, what have you.
Kill the roses. Don't kill them.
Right. Anyhow, I just want to say thank you, you guys. It was wonderful. It was a great discussion, and there's so much more we can talk about. take a seat up here?
These gentlemen, they actually were also part of the panel, and they could have...
They're on DJ time. They're at Highland Park DJ
time.
They have
full-time jobs.
Start with Miguel. I'm going to use the restroom. Sorry, buddy.
Well, in that case, Dan, let's just have a... Let's just sit around in a circle. We've got Caesar from the Twins. We've got Alex Tercero. We've got...
So if you guys want to
dance in a circle.
I've done this before, actually. If you guys want to, like, take a thing around the line to us, and you guys are going to have some drinks, and you're going to love it. Why don't we, what do you think about that? Open it up.
Someone like Adrian.
You don't have to go on any corner.
You want to lead that? You want to lead that?
Lead the truth.
When the party broke up.
Oh,
you want to go?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, I just want to... maybe perhaps open this... up to some more questions from the audience. Does anyone, would anyone like to start? Any questions for any of the panel?
We just wanted to follow up with a little bit on this subject we're talking about.
You know what? Does it sound better right now, like without the microphone?
Or what do you guys think?
Yes.
With the mic? Okay.
What was your thing?
All right. I'd like to give Miguel an opportunity to introduce himself to everyone. Here you go. Sit down. We're all cool. We're just chilling. Relax. All right.
Good afternoon, evening, guys. My name is Miguel Gutierrez. I used to go by DJ Reckless, and I'm still, to this day, a rude one. And goes back as early as 83. And I have an old bio that I wrote for some promoters in San Francisco, and it's the only copy I have of something that's old, but it's really cool and funny, so you guys enjoy that. We'll read it. Other than that, we used to roll with a crew called... Night Society and San Fernando Valley's Crazy Cuts, and somehow, she mentioned, there was always different areas. There's not every area represented their own crews and parties and did things. And somehow, we got some folks from the valley, some guys from East LA, Highland Park, and all that stuff, and then we started meeting other folks, people that we wanted to actually have come out to parties, like the Hamburger Helper and what have you. That brought us a connection towards everybody. Then we started DJing, and of course later met, all these cats here. And it was phenomenal after that. It's historic, and that's where we're here now.
Okay, since we're opening it up, I know there's several DJs here that been kindly here on time. do you guys want to say something? You've DJed in house parties in Southgate. Alex Marcelo. You want to give us a little history of how the house parties came to Southgate, and how, what did you do? What was your crew out there?
Wow, I think the stories are very similar to what I've been hearing. I grew up in Compton, and my early I fell in love with turntables when I used to see the KDA White going to high schools, Davis Junior High, Compton High. Then after that, we moved to Southgate, so I got started with a crew called the Uncomparables. It was the GQs and the Uncomparables, which we used to play with Lenny V, Orlando, DJ Orlando. And it was, I think we had one of the best crews, not to say, around that area, because we used to do the same thing, go against all the other crews in South Carolina with Punch and Pub, crews that were doing backyard parties. I mean, we used to have, 500 people in a backyard party.
In Compton.
In Southgate. Not forget about it. That was a whole different story. That's another story.
That's a record.
That's a record. But, we're a bunch of young guys that wanted to party and meet girls and, and have fun. For me, it was an experience because I came, like I said, I came from a very violent world from Compton, and going into Southgate High, it was awesome, man. I got to meet Eddie Zane, which was one of the guys that gave me the name Alex Tercero.
Oh, the origin story.
Because I was the third Alex in Southgate. It was DJ Alex I, and then there was another guy by the name of Alex G. And so he said, you know what, since you're the third Alex now, the third DJ Alex in Southgate, I was the third, all right. So we started, playing here, there, everywhere, and, passing out flyers and getting our name known. And I got to play at Betty's Pasta House. We did a couple of events right there. Got to party in Orange County. That was a hell of an experience, too, because the Orange County was a big scene in the 80s with the whole freestyle, So, same stories, passing out flyers, doing bodies in the backyard. We used to rent house park. I mean, we used to rent the houses from, friends that we used to have. We used to tell them, hey, tell your mom to give her $200 if, we can use the house. They would ask. I was like, wow.
I got it on budget.
Organized.
Exactly. We had connections with, so we were paying like $200, I believe, for every house. So, it was fun. It was fun. The 80s and 90s, it was great.
All right. So we've been talking about Northeast LA. Now you've included Southgate. Is there anybody that wants to, you want to include Montebello?
Where you at? Montebello?
Montebello. What about the heart of East LA? Were you guys around in that house, in the house party era? You want to, come on, you guys got to come say something.
Well, we, in 77, at the house, and we had this back room where we had wrought iron in the balcony. And when the cops would come to bust the parties, the door was closed, and honestly, like, they brought us one beer, so we sound for $1 a beer. But what happened was, we were doing it every week, so we were the first ones to get a city ordinance against us that if we do any more parties, we go to jail.
Wow. Where was this at? Where about exactly? Also, in the county, unincorporated.
That's right.
In the county, still in.
County.
And I was like, can they do that?
You were dealing with the sheriffs.
Yeah.
Sheriffs. They came and gave us a paper from the court that we could do one more party. We all went and did.
And then from there, for Ultimate Crate, you guys went on to just do.
We looked for halls. Pegasus used to be us, Pegasus, and before you know it, Pegasus, we take our money that we made from a party, and we go buy, here's four speakers, and Pegasus makes people go out and buy eight speakers. Before you know it, they go this or that,
Okay, point of clarification.
Okay.
There's a legendary myth of Pegasus and Electra shutting down blocks in East LA to have one sound system on one side of the street, one side, another. It was always Pegasus versus Electra. Is this
Sound
true?
Flash.
I haven't heard that story. I didn't answer that question.
No? Okay, so it remains a myth. No. This was like for, I heard these stories in like 80. Like I was in junior high and people would come from East LA. We this is a topic that's really come up a lot. And I'm going to make a really big, weird connection here, being that we're looking at possibly voting for an African-American president. Growing up in South Central, we used to have a lot of raza hop on the bus to go to schools in East LA because a variety of reasons. The schools were perceived to be better. I personally went to Lincoln because I liked the music program, but there was a lot of people from South Central that were going to schools on the East Side because their parents didn't want them hanging out with black people. And so when I go to my junior high parties and stuff, I get a lot of these kids from Pico Union, South Central, that were going to schools on the East Side, and they'd come back with all these stories about East LA, and it was like a magical land. You know, it was all brown, and that's where that story came from Pegasus and Electra doing these battles against each other, and that I just wanted to see if you had a part of that.
No.
Okay, that's cool. But you see how I kind of want to read it?
Yeah.
All right, this is one of our latecomers, Chris.
Yes. Thank you, Jerry. I apologize for being late. But I'm still looking for locations to have backyard parties. My name is Chris Gutierrez. I'm Miguel's younger brother and sort of the predecessor of what happened in Highland Park, which was the bigger star on the Thomas Guidebook when it came to small unincorporated cities. And the reason for that was its historical culture. I didn't know what I was getting into. You have a question? No? Okay. I was about to say, wow. But anyway, I'm the predecessor of a group that started in the early 80s, Jam Pack Productions. I used to MC their parties. I was 11 years old, and I already had a deep voice. I used to smoke, but that's another story. I liked the music department at Lincoln, but I chose Franklin High School to attend and just went under the program of Richard Gonzalez, and the rest is history. He was a great music director and dance coordinator. But before then, it was the boys from Little Hustler, a guy named Walter, from South Central Los Angeles, who moved to Cypress Park, who just kind of introduced me to a lot of different things. So I eventually picked up graffiti art and started getting on the 81 bus heading towards MacArthur Park in the early 80s. And from listening to MCs, hosts, I started meeting MCs at pretty big disco parties. MC Huey Louie. What can I tell you about that guy? Legendary. Legendary. He's one of the biggest in the business. Or was. We're all catching up to him. Then there was the big voices from radio, you know, guys that you couldn't touch. They're just like, wow, look at these guys. But then there was local guys in my neighborhood, like Mr. Microphone. Mr. Mike, MC Waldo, if anybody knew him. Pretty classic, because he kind of embraced a lot of neighborhoods and made it cool for people to hang around with each other. Because, you know, there was the Posse, those were all cats who relocated from South Central, Crenshaw, they're all from Manual Arts, you know, Alley High, things like that. But having music in the blood from a kid playing the drums, joining the music department at Mangel Junior High School, meeting the hip hoppers, hanging out at the Radiotron, I was hoping Carmelo would be here, and we could elaborate later. But from then on, I had a breakaway. My brother went to the military and joined a draft, a school scholarship program that pretty much took him away from all that party. And I guess that was a good thing, because we were getting out of control. We had legendary parties that had about 700 people in the backyard. And there are not very many big backyards in Highland Park, but there were legendary parties, and there was legendary girl promoters, and some of them are here now. And it became a thing where I'm like, you know what, that's their thing. I joined on to that. For me, it was when I took a perfect attendance challenge and had all my friends and people who weren't my friends in high school, in junior high, encouraged them to go to school, because if the best homeroom who with the perfect attendance was able to do anything, they were able to go to Catalina Island with the KDAY Mixmasters. And that just changed my whole life. Watching these guys do that on boats, as the boats are going across the Pacific Ocean to Catalina, and watching like Mixmaster Mike, Bobcat, the Arabian Prince, all these guys, it just became a thing where when they started coming to my high school and playing locally, like, yeah, these guys are in their backyard, it just became a thing. That era came, went. These boys started doing work over at Infinity Broadcasting, over at Power. But anyways, that's another story. Because my backyard history started when I became the leader of a group called the Anti-Socialist Republic. And that was so long. I was an artist, so graffiti. I was Helter of Skelter, Helter Skelter Graphics 88. good friend of mine. Humble Graphics, good friends. But I went on to go look for the guys from Lion, Fastlane, Atlantic Printing, just to see what these guys were doing, cranking them out. So I used to go and crank these out. And I did the flyers for Jam Pack Productions, and I worked with my brother and with other guys, and eventually the flyers got bigger and bigger. The names got longer and longer. So I said, you know what? I'm going to do my own thing. He went to the military, and I started a group called the Antisocials. And I'm the leader of the Antisocials. I went by many names, but besides that, I guess my biggest claim in East L.A. is being born at my memorial on the 2nd was to have 2,000 people at El Herrero for the first time when L.A. County came in and shook down the boys and the Antisocials with a lot of people. I want to say somewhere in the thousands.
Hey, didn't you used to play in a band? I remember right there at the Maravilla Project across the street.
That's right.
There's a half a bullet.
That's right.
And I was DJing there, and you were DJing there, and then my band played there, and then your band played there.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, that's crazy, because we kind of crossed.
We did cross paths. See, back then it was like, you know, growing up in hip-hop, it wasn't about hip-hop. There's a beautiful song called Hip-Hop, Bebop, Blondie, all this, you know, rap, disco, rock. Everything kind of clashed. And in East L.A., you know, while the Brown Berets were fighting for peace, and while Cultural Affairs was trying to spend more money and there was no budget, there was bands that got together and formed. I had to get in a car. I went to Orange County. It's great you mentioned that because there is a 30-mile radius of what really happened. And for me to go to El Torito in Redondo Beach and ask permission from a gentleman named Mike Ness, leader of the Social Distortion Band, yes, you can use my name. I said, no, I don't want to be a cover band. I want to start something else. We're called Social Exploits. We played a, you know, they recorded our demos. It was something where it was legendary because we came from a studio in Silver Lake, the Holly Gully Studio, which is no longer there. There's a titty joint there now, but that's another story. That's where the Germs, X, Red Hot Chili Peppers, and the last guy to actually be in there was Beck. He has the whole story of Neil Young, but that's another story. It all comes back to East L.A. where it's like, hire my fame. In the backyard, off of Indiana, or streets I never heard of, and started about 15 crews myself. Everybody wanted to jump on board. And I'm like, you know what? I make all my flyers with Electroset. They're scratch on. I'm the original black and white artist. And all of a sudden, it became a big thing. I took that from punk rock and I made it to hip hop, and then it just became new wave, and then it just became disco. And it went 360, and meeting Willie at the top of City Terrace, way before, you know, when managers were getting put away, put in jail, incarcerated, and bands were like, what do we do now? Guys like Willie stepped in. When Quinto Sol was like at its wit, like, what's going to happen? Limon got busted. People like Willie kept going. The Peace and Justice Center, same guy, Carmelo, Radiotron, Peace and Justice, 14 other projects that help the youth today. He's another guy who kept us together. It just kept going. And now, you know, from Ozomali to Quinto Sol to Blues Experiment to all these bands that I used to host and just say, hey, let's get together. Our people, I mean, I used to do a thing called the Cuernavaca in Pasadena, and the cops used to show up and say, what, turn that off. I've got Social Distortion inside, and I got like a couple of guys no one's ever heard of opening up for them. And people were like, this is cool. This isn't about color. This is about what we're capable of doing. It goes back to the plugs in the 70s, early 80s. It goes back to original punk rock, like the previous show that Sandra was involved with, Vex. It's all tied in somehow, some way. But, you know, this could go on and on. My favorite memory is being a part of it. Because there was times where you couldn't play the music. There was times when people would put a gun to your head. There was times when, you know, boyfriends would be fighting other boyfriends. And girlfriends were being bad girlfriends or good girlfriends and the boyfriends and vice versa. And it just became a thing where relationships and all this crazy asexual, bisexual, all this awkward boy shit.
It was the Aquanet Wars.
The Aquanet Wars. We're out of control. They were out of control. And it's like we can go on, but it's like, honestly, for me, it's a movement. Being a part of something as a kid and there's a reason for continuing the movement. I mean, I had a friend who started a band. It's called The Movement. Everybody should start a band if you get a chance. Johnny V's over here. I mean, I see people in the one half of the Twins here, the Pretty Pleasers.
Oh, you're going to start a fight now.
I'm going to start a fight.
Keep your daughter home once. Mira cómo te vas, cómo te portas. Question. It killed pretty much, I think I was talking earlier about a DJ group that became the East Lake Boys and, you know, one of the biggest crack dealing gangs in Lincoln Heights. It pretty much killed the house party scene, I believe, because by then it was no longer about fun. And even, you know, just looking at the history of gangs, it was always about, you know, oh, don't cross my street or whatever. Now when crack came in, it was money, and money makes people pull out some crazy weapons and no mercy. And then you're strung out on that and there's no limit. But it basically killed it, and like, you know, like, it coincided with Willie and Chris going into the band scene, where there was more of a message, you know,
rebellion.
A rebellion against what they saw, I guess, in your neighborhoods. And for me, by 88, 89, you know, I was hearing about, you know, the underground, like the burgeoning underground, the house music, acid house in particular. Some friends of Willie's were very involved in that. Adrian from Prism? Adrian, he would DJ as DJ Adrian, or he was part of Prism. And they had a place on 7th Street at this little bar called Bernal's, and they just did acid house at Sexpress. And, you know, I would hear about Alex I and Orlando and Southgate and Reza and Lenny V, and they had this thing called Housegate, because there were so many house parties going on. And we ran into this guy named Raul, who would always break into warehouses, and they would call him running all warehouses or running as wetback. Either way, he ended up called R-A-W. And he ended up pioneering the drum and bass jungle scene. And so, yeah, crack pushed us, some of us, into other types of music, and all of us into different types of music, but into different branches. Like, you know, they went into the live, and I went more, even more electronic and more international DJ scene, you know, because now we're talking about connecting the Chicago, Detroit, New York, Manchester scenes with DJing and acid house. Anybody else want to talk about crack?
I have one story about crack, and it's the way it was introduced to me. You had a question?
No, I didn't.
Finish your crack.
Okay. Quick, my wife's crack. It was Richard had booked, Richard Gonzalez, who's a dance coordinator at Franklin High. He had booked the Wrecking Crew to come to Franklin and perform two songs. Okay. That's all we knew. There was an argument. I was supposed to play first, and I was the youngest, and it was like of honor to play first. I was 12 years old. Greg Mack was hosting. Anyway, make a long story short, they rushed. They said, we got to get out of here. We got another high school to go to, because as Alex mentioned, high schools are very popular. And, you know, I think Greg Mack was hosting 5 high schools in one night. That's how busy he was. But he's like, look, there's these guys here. They don't know anybody. Just talk to them. You're the first DJ, right? What do you need to play? I'm like, play some hip-hop. I was hanging out at Duran's Records, and this catwalk with a box of records, and these are the Beastie Boys. And this is LL Cool J. No one's heard this. Okay. You know? So I played 15 minutes. The radio went live on the air, and these guys came out with their records, and they were trying to take over the radio spot. I tried to pull the set together. Eventually, my 20 minutes were over. And I hung out with these guys in the parking lot underneath the bridge at Franklin High School. So I'm like, okay, I'm supposed to talk to you guys. I'm like, oh yeah, well, you're the only kid playing hip-hop. Everyone else is playing some gay shit, quote unquote. I'm like, well, who are you guys? I said, well, we're niggers with attitude. I'm like, oh, okay, that's, whoa, okay. What do you guys do? What do you guys up to? Gangster rap. They're like, here, listen to our music. They opened up the trunk of the Impala. I think it was Ice Cube driving.
And it was Eazy-E's.
Eazy-E holds up his first 12-inch and says, here you go, kid. He was cruising down the streets. Boys in the Hood. And they also offered me, they opened up their palms, were like, hey, you want some of this? I'm like, what is this? They're like, it's crack cocaine, kid. I said, you know what? No, I don't want none of that. What are those? Mixtapes? Give me some of that. What you got over there? 12-inch? Give me some of that. But that was my first run-in with it, and then before I knew it, it was total devastation. A lot of people went down. That's my story.
Great story.
You know, we're
this is a tradition, folks. We from 77 to 2007, from Orange County to Compton to South Bay to Moco of Lincoln Heights, Highland, everywhere. We've all done and felt the same thing. Your Marantz player, my homeboy Fusion, who plays minimal techno, started on turntables that he had to put together, you know, in an electronic shop. And he was too poor to do, you know, and this is our thing, you know, and we all have a slice of the story, you know, and that's why we're doing this, to get everybody together to tell their slice of the story. I just, the little drop that I wrote, that's half a drop of the story. You know, I was lucky enough to have Willie interviewed, and, you know, some other head DJs, main DJs that I found a connection with in terms of the story. But, you know, there needs to be, you know, Paul's story, Santi's story, Alex's story, Caesar's story, Johnny's story. Everybody's story needs to be put into these binders and their flyers. We need to videotape you telling your side of the story. We're planning future panels. One future panel that we're going to have is with Santi here and Alex. And we're going to look at how these guys, you know, moved into the other area of music, you know, rock and español and Latin music. I mean, it's the biggest thing right now around the world. China is all about Latin music right now. And these brothers came out, you know, as you heard Alex come out of this milieu of backyard parties. And now, you know, he's the drive time DJ at 107, you know, at Super Estrella. Santi is a mixer on there. And we're going to get other heads that have taken this culture to a global level, but not in, again, not in that European or Anglo world, but in our language, you know, and that's something we need to respect as well. You know, I know that the lengua, you know, some of us doesn't really translate too much into the regular DJ Latino scene, but it's a big, strong strand, and they're representing on many levels.
Hey, Jerry, if I can interrupt, can I ask that to acknowledge all the important people here?
Church one day and I said, hey mom, I'm going to be a DJ with Tony. They go, oh, with that guy? But is there anybody else? Ruben?
Yeah,
dude,
you kind of touched on this a little bit, and Chris, you touched on this too, but I was kind of wondering if you could talk a little more about that. Really were involved with like, the generation of the 90s and stuff that was going on with the pirate radio and all that, like more like kind of more conscious political stuff. I was wondering if you could connect the DJ culture to that how those things kind of bridge and stuff.
Well, it's funny you say that. The integration process when it came to culture and broadcasting, I mean, KPFK had always been Radio Pacifica and had given people chances. When LA lost its biggest hip-hop radio station, you know, when pirate radio came up out of the air, and there was, you know, La X and the Mighty 690 that were still broadcasting from San Diego and Encinitas, we were pretty much conditioned and spoon-fed, you know, pretty standard radio, which, you know, we all grow in love, you know, fond memories of fun things that were happening, but politically, for me, it started happening in East LA with Willie, and Peace and Justice was a big, big political step towards something, and, you know, just being able to fund your own project and live under your own roof and pretty much create what you wanted to create and put it back out there, it was like a big microwave or a macro wave of just able to bounce off things. I mean, this was beyond just backyards. It just became, you know, an in-house project. And politically, people started doing things. Marchas, we got involved with quite a bit of things. Willie can elaborate some more because he was what I call one of the big antennas back in the day that was tuned into things. And to this day is. I mean, the story he told me about Mexico and being up in Chiapas, and that's still, you know, some of the early stuff. I mean, for me, when people talk about Marcos and, you know, some of the guys from Oyin, we have a personal friend who jumped off the 6th Street Bridge. You know, these are things that politically people want to do to change something. You know, obviously, there's, you know, depression and repression, and there's certain subjects that people don't want to talk about. But, you know, we were sort of in the dark for a lot of years. I mean,
because of the music.
And, yeah, basically, the music wasn't telling us much. I mean,
the music was telling us point.
Yeah, it was all about, when you listen to music, just forget about your troubles and look away.
But even the music, like in the early days when we were DJing, like it had a message to it, you know, like a lot of the early 80s music, a lot of the mid 80s music, and even a
still had a message of love, a message of understanding, a message of evolution. Then once like techno and reggae music started coming in, like there was no more message, it was just all about the beats. From what I remember from a DJ, like from the awesome foursome, my perspective on DJing was to play something you've never heard before. Something that was going to cause people to kind of have a different perspective the next day when they wake up. I always try to play things that were new. But when there was no more direction with the lyrics, when there was no more direction
direct
with music,
contact with people.
Yeah, like when you're playing music that says love disco style and then it goes into boing boing boing, like it for me I felt kind of like it just wasn't sane enough. So I stopped DJing for a few minutes of the day.
You started playing
writing music.
And you know,
going back to writing music that had a message.
Yeah,
because we went from that disco style, we went to like Robin S and Show Me Some Love, and then after that, there was no more lyrics. Seriously, I didn't find any music. Even today, I play house music, new music that don't have lyrics, has great music, great percussion, but there's no music. Like, there's no, you can't gather, even like right now, we can't gather these people and say nothing. We can't just gather these people and just play records. It's not going to be enough. There's going to be questions. There's going to be some kind of interaction. And us, who are responsible for gathering the masses as promoters, as female or male promoters, as DJs, as organizers, like, there had to be some kind of something coming out of it, you know? And in the and early 90s, like, I started playing music,
yeah.
You know?
All right. I got to defend Ray.
Okay.
Okay. In 1988 was the Summer of Love in Manchester, England. They had massive raves of 20,000 people in the rain, because you know it's always raining in England. The cops would come in and crack heads. That spread out throughout the world. Okay, people heard about that. And for me, I mean, no offense, Willie, the Awesome Foursome and all them were cool, but by 88, 89, it was all about GQ and Morrissey. And it seemed like East LA was in a time war. There wasn't nothing about playing nothing new.
Right.
You know, I have
a right to opinion.
But we went into Sex Express and found Acid House.
That's great.
And in Acid House, you know, we went into the inner journey, you know, through the assistance of the substances available at the time.
Sure.
And the music was, there sometimes wasn't any lyrics, but sometimes you didn't need to be told to love your neighbor because by this time, it was about feeling that beat together, and it was and I found it on a very indigena level, and I told you about this way before, in a tribal level.
That's right.
And you know, my thing starts off with the DJ as a shaman.
Right.
He gathers knowledge and sounds from around the world that don't even have necessarily an overt message, but if you're in tune, you hear it, and you see it in all the bodies around you. You're no longer looking towards the DJ, but you're looking at the body, at the public. And that's what I really enjoyed about the rave thing, is that, we destroyed the pyramid of the DJ being the center, of the band being the focus. It was no longer about going to go see something or go hear something or have someone tell you something. It was like, I'm now as much of an important factor of this good time as the DJ, as the song, as everything else, because this is now a rave and I am responsible for myself. It's about peace, love, unity, and respect, plur, which was the early mantra, a booming bass for a loving race. And it was all of us together. We didn't have to have anybody tell us to love one another. We already knew. And we didn't need to have a leader because everybody was a potential leader.
Yeah, because there wasn't like gang fights in the rain.
No.
Not to this day. We just had Electric Daisy Carnival with 70,000 people.
Yeah.
You cannot get a rock concert to pull that. You cannot get a hip-hop concert.
The other Altamont.
70,000 people
last year we pulled 75,000 on 6th Street for the Día de los Muertos.
Oh, but that's 3 days, and that's city sponsored, and it's an art variety show.
Yeah, we've been there for 9 years.
Yeah.
So it's a new guy.
This is 15 years.
Witch doctor.
Just DJs, and not, I don't think any semblance of violence, and it's not a cultural, and it's not a spiritual. It's just a booming bass for a loving race.
But like everything else, it's evolution of the music. Sorry, evolution of the music and how things are projected and how people perceive. I mean, there's always, you know, fast-forwarding movements.
Let me tell you, I just got back from tour in Mexico. We were in Mexico, and my band was on one stage. Stephen Marty was on another stage. But as soon as Moby went on stage, forget it. It's like our band didn't exist. There was no such thing as Bob Marley. Everybody ran from every single stage to go see Moby. And then next thing you know, it was just like 40, 50, 60,000, 21 and under children just like dancing. Like non-stop. And you're right. Like, it's evolved to the level where you don't have to say much, you don't have to do much. Just that whole communal like environment just evolves people to the next level, for sure, for sure.
We have a question.
What are the main things regardless of who else you have history with? They all come down to one thing. Everybody likes to party with the captain. You wanted to be there,
you wanted to be there.
I was at that party. And it's still the same today. When people don't look at who's playing, what's going on, they're looking at what they can say. I was at that party, it was happening. It's still that culture.
It is.
It's a good point.
Whether it's 75,000 or 75 or six of us, JB was there, Gabriel Pegasus was there. We're like at this exclusive thing, you know? Huh? Money. Six of us, JB. Come on.
I mean, it all boils down to tribalism, I would think.
Let's wrap up this time. Let's just hang out. We'll put on some beats. There's still a couple of things in the ice chest. I know some of you might have work to do. And thank you for coming. Next week we're going to put another panel together. In the coming weeks we'll have other panels. Tell your friends. It's not alpha beta, but tell your friends.